This is the summer edition of Music 101. I'm Sam Wicks, and joining me in studio is Zane Lowe, expat music head, BBC Radio 1 DJ, and all-round music fan.
Thanks, man.
How you doing, man?
Good, good to see you.
You're not so fresh off the back of a trip to Fiji.
Yeah, me and the family went out to Fiji at a difficult time for that place, you know, and a day and a half into some beautiful weather, obviously the storms hit and the floods hit and the water levels rose and things got a bit crazy.
Yeah.
So, but good, really good people, and it's been pretty horrible to see what they're going through, but we're back in Auckland now for some sunshine.
This is an annual visit, right?
Yeah, the first time to Fiji, but we always come home pretty much, yeah. Especially we've got kids now, and my wife's from New Zealand, and all our family here, so we love coming back.
Are New Zealand holidays scouting opportunities with music these days?
Yeah, I mean, I come home and I don't separate myself from what I do. I don't sort of switch off the computer and don't listen to music. I couldn't survive without music. And I do log on and check for things, and I'm still on Hype Machine, I'm still on the blogs, looking around. And it's different this year because I'm DJing. Rather than just on the radio, which I've been doing in the UK for a while. I'm sort of a little more in the thick of it on this break. But, I definitely go back to Britain refreshed. I do step out of the box for a bit.
Kirsten Johnston and myself caught your New Year's Eve show in Wellington.
Yeah, down at the Shared Six.
It seemed you were catering to everyone. Every box was ticked. You know, I went from rock to hip-hop to
I just
trance.
Want to be liked, Sam. I just want people to like me.
You hit them on side.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's something that I've worked on for a while out in the UK under the radar, mainly DJing outside of London. You know, I've really enjoyed it. It's been a part of my personality, the performance aspect, which I haven't been able to do and obviously didn't really get a chance to do with Breaks Co-op so much. And it's just more of a direct reflection of what I do on radio, which is cover all these different styles, but it's done more of like a party set, like the greats, like a Ronson or a Z-Trip would do. These are people who I'd consider myself, hopefully, fingers crossed, in the same loose category of. And, you know, you approach it from a hip-hop point of view and then cover every style of music, but just do it in a fairly hyperactive way.
Yeah.
You know, and try and sell it on the night and let the music just drive people.
We've got you in today to present your mixtape.
Mm.
You're a man schooled in hip-hop culture and schooled in mixtape culture as a result of that.
Very much so. In fact, the name of the thing that I do out in the UK, which is the kind of the loose term for all my gigs and anything outside of my radio and TV commitments is called home taping. So, you know, and it's the boombox with the mixtape. So, I mean, I'm right into it. I think that in this day and age, this is an obvious statement, but with iTunes and iPods and playlists and everyone, whether they realize it or not, is making mixtapes.
Are you still hip to new music through mixtapes that people present to you?
Not so much. I mean, you know, I look out for ones by specific artists who are hot and coming up. So, and that's mainly in hip hop. Like, I like the Diplo and Santo Gold mixtape, and I'm really into the Kid Cudi mixtape, which Plain Pat and Emile made. So, if I know someone's coming through and they've got something on the street, which is generally just kind of a freestyle or a throwdown of what they're capable of, I'll definitely check for it. But most of the time, I look for my new music either through the loose network of people that you associate with just through your job who tip you off or through MySpace links that are sent to you or through blogs, you know.
You assembled your mixtape this morning. Is there any kind of theme that runs through it?
Well, there wasn't. I just was going through kind of looking for a broad selection of music that would cover my interests at the minute. But the more I look at it, the more I realize that there are kind of stories of me being put onto these bands or these songs. At least in the beginning, it seems that way. And, you know, if we're going to start now with My Morning Jacket, there's a band that I've been just criminally slow on. And, you know, friends of mine who we pretty much share taste in a lot of different music have said to me, you know, this is a band, I'm amazed you haven't heard any of their records. And it just took me a long time. And then the last sort of couple of months, I've worked from in reverse, started on their new album, I think it's Evil Urges, and they've just been going through and just think they're absolutely brilliant and sort of part embarrassed for not getting it early as you would be, but also really sort of overjoyed at the fact I've got all this music to discover now, which is what is one of the upsides of discovering a band later on. So, I love them.
I'm
My Morning Jacket, I'm amazed. They actually played The Big Day Out last Friday.
Yeah.
You talked about being slow to move on My Morning Jacket.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it's incumbent upon you to be up on all this new music coming through because you're a gateway drug, right, to other audiences.
Yeah, I mean, the time slot, just by the necessity of the station that it's on, the audience that you have available to you, and what we're allowed to play, which is whatever we want, you know, because they trust us.
You feel that pressure, or you just go with your instinct and
you break? Do, but at the same time, you need to be able to put your hands up and say, I missed that, and we're going to make up for lost time. And it doesn't, you know, what I've learned is, you know, I was pretty late on Arcade Fire, and it didn't affect my relationship or the audience's relationship with the band. There are other DJs out there, obviously. It's not the only show. In fact, it's one of many. DJs like Steve Lamacq, Hugh Stevens, all over bands like that. And, you know, they support them, and the band do great. And then we pick up on when it feels right. And as long as we're willing to say, you know, hands up, okay, we've been a bit late on this, the audience respect it, I think, and they just want to know that you're going to make up for it now, you know, which we, you know, we've done, and we'll do.
This is Music 101 on Radio New Zealand National, and next up we're going to early 90s boom bap hip hop.
Backpack, as they call it, man.
DITC.
Yeah, that's right, Digging in the Crates, Diamond D. When I was looking at artists that I wanted to play in this part, kind of representing that part of my life, there's so many. And, you know, I could have gone Leaders of the New School, Brand Nubian, Tribe Called Quest, obviously, De La Soul. There's countless. Souls of Mischief, Del. But I wanted to go with an artist that I rediscovered recently and just remembered how brilliant this album is. And I was a bit hard on Diamond lyrically at the time because I was rapping heavily at the time and just thought that he'd wasted all these amazing beats that he had by talking this kind of pedestrian producer. Because producers that rap traditionally are lazy, are a bit lame. You know,
but it's an afterthought.
You sort of go, okay, like Pete Rock, you don't expect him to spit mad ill rhymes. Someone's ghostwritten his rhymes for him, probably. And if not, you know, he's got some ability, but he's not hitting, he's not the sharpest blade. When you're in the middle of it, you're like, oh, you wasted that beat. I could have spit, you know, been so much better on it. You know what I mean? And now I listen back to that record and I realize that it's kind of perfect. And his lazy approach and the fact that he's not trying to do kind of like metaphysical and quizzical rhymes, physical rhymes, you know, he's not trying to be super, you know, super scientific about it, really suits. But more than anything, I've realized with a bit of age that this is probably one of the most influential records for me as a hip-hop producer in any of the work I've ever done, which has obviously predominantly been in New Zealand. This album, Diamond D, the record, is just kind of the bar, and it's still the bar, and that's what's freaky, is that the beats are still insane and the album's still pretty much flawless. So this is Diamond and Diamond D freestyle.
Hey, yo, wait a minute.
Yo, that's that shit.
Hey, yo, turn it up.
Yo, that's that shit.
Yo, could you fix the station?
Yo, that's that shit.
Yo, watch them fluff it up.
Yo, that's that shit.
Shit, I got your head bopping. Ain't no stopping, cause the shit that I'm popping is from the heart, so you know that I'm real. So you can relax, cause I'm signed and sealed. Know a lot of faces in this rap shit. Always got a buck, cause I don't make whack shit. Yeah, you either like it or you don't. The sounds are natural and in fact you will stand in awe and watch your brother catch wreck. My credit is good and I never bounced a check. But if the funds run low and my shit gets critical, I'm off to the chemical. Gotta give a shout to the Lord Professor. Thought I lost his number, but I left it on my dresser. On and on like the Mississippi. Not on a gangster tip, and yo, I'm not a hippie. I'm just an ordinary brother who was very dedicated to real rap. So don't compare me to another brother, cause I'm a type that'll smother a whack MC, the DJ, or any other member of your crew. Not a thing you can do. Nope. Gotta say peace to Infinite Kin do. Showbiz, Fat Joe, Poopy, and a bad chap. No one can match me, and yo, you couldn't catch me in a new pair of British with a thick rubber sole. But I won't flinch, cause I got soul. And I bring joy just like Anita Baker. If the girl doesn't like the smile, you need to take her to a Diamond D show. Cause I bring joy to men women, girls, boys. Jews, Gentiles, Catholics, Protestants, step to Diamond D, it'll be your abolishment. I'll give a handshake for you and your man's sake. Cause I write rhymes so much that my hands ache. It's 92, so what you gonna do? What you gonna do? Barbecue or boogaloo? Yeah. Hey, yo, wait a minute.
Yo, that's that shit.
Yo, could you turn it up?
Yo, that's that shit.
Hey, yo, fix the station.
Yo, that's that shit.
Yo, watch them both get up.
Yo, damn, I can't jam.
1992 boom bap.
Is that what it was?
Lots of head nods.
Now I feel old. That sounded amazing, man. And I really love that album so much. And I think Diamond D, that record is just brilliant. And yeah, man, everything about it is pretty much there. And there's heavier stuff on there as well, which is really good.
This is your era of music we're talking here. This is what sort of formed Leaders of Style.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, that is. I mean, as far as my love of rap music is concerned, it was before that. But in terms of participating, you know, the few years that I would say we were very active in the scene, which was, you know, the transition from Leaders of Style to Urban Disturbance through probably to the completion of the Damn Native record, that's all I listen to.
Even though you run the gamut on your Radio 1 show, would it be fair to say that hip-hop is the aesthetic that holds it all together?
Yep, definitely. It's the thing that, you know, it probably sets me apart. And Britain certainly is the thing that people, whether they like me or not, will draw some reaction to. They'll go, oh, that's the guy that kind of drops it. At least initially, they be like, you know, he talks with the hip-hop slang. Or he, you know, the way we put it together definitely has that kind of hip-hop mixtape vibe to show itself.
What's up next in your mixtape?
Well, I called my friend this morning, Seth, and said, you know, should I play some Radiohead? I'll play some Thom Yorke. And he said, I don't know. I can't answer that. But in the end, I pressed him and he said, go for some Thom Yorke because it'll be slightly more unexpected. Anything that Tom really has been involved in, whether it's Radiohead, a solo career, or any collaboration, like from, you know, PJ Harvey right through to Bjork or whatever he's done, I can't fault. And the reason I wanted to go with Razor in the title track is because, you know, even though I love everything Radiohead has done and I can't stop listening to it in rainbows, I think that Eraser is an amazing achievement because he's been able to take music, which I think for the longest time has been accused of being cold or unemotional, and perhaps with the exception of, perhaps along with people like maybe Aphex Twin, Björk and a few others, he's been able to make an album which has made those sounds and those instruments just sound so emotional, and even more emotional, I think, than organic music, you know, bass, guitar, drums and everything else. He's made computers weep with this album, I reckon. And this is a Razor. This is incredible. Album just kills me.
That's the song that CRS jumped over, right? Child Rebel Soldier.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Pharrell, Kanye, Lupe Fiasco.
Yeah, and they did. Yeah, it sounded good. I mean, I like that. I like when rappers can take things which are unexpected. Kid Cudi's done that on that mixtape. You know, he did it over the Paul Simon, and he rapped over Band of Horses, and like Rat Tat Tat got a rinsing as well. So I like it when rappers, you know, they get deeper into influences than just, you know, the jazz and the funk or whatever. Southern style. But that Thom Yorke record is just outrageous, and I just can't fault him.
Yeah, he's had an enviable career, right? He's like a Damon Albarn character.
If you ask him.
Oh, really? What would he tell you?
No, of course. He's, you know, he would agree, but I don't think it's easy. I don't think making music like that is easy for them. I think it comes in a great personal kind of challenge.
You had a chance to pick the man's brains?
A few times, yeah. And, you know, interesting. Over the years, you know, he's warmed up to me a bit, as you do when you meet people over and over again. But, he's, you know, he's funny, you know. The last time I met him was actually a real joy, you know, because he was in such good space with the In Rainbows thing. It had really happened. The experiment with how they released it had been a success. It was critically acclaimed. People loved the record. It was considered to be their best record for a long time. And he was just in a really joyous mood and funny and cracking jokes. And the thing I remember the most is after the interview, which was cool, and it was with him and Ed, and that's generally how it rolls. And I think one of us said afterwards, oh, listen, would you like to dip? You know, I'm away on holiday and we have musicians or personalities step in on the show. It's happening right now. Damon Albarn just did one this morning, our time. And we were just expecting a flat out no. And he was just like, yeah, man, I'd love that. And he did his little, you know, Thom Yorke, like, absolute enthusiasm. That'd be amazing. Let's do that, you know. And true to his word, a week later, they were confirmed. They were one of the first to confirm. So I think when they want to do something, there's nothing that stands in the way. But they're just very cautious, and that's why people are so protective of them, because they're protective of their music.
Your show on Radio 1 is your baby. Are you nervous when you go away on holiday and there are other folks stepping in and taking over that playlist?
Well, first and foremost, that show's been around for a while. Other people have done it. So, yeah, absolutely, it feels like my baby now, but I'm fully aware of the fact that at some point it has to be handed over. Hopefully not for 20 years, but at some point.
You could do this into your dotage. You could be that John Peel character, you know?
Some days I feel like it, and some days I think it would be completely, you know, it would be completely pathetic to try and continue to do it. But, I don't want to stop. But no, I don't, because I think what's cool is the fact that having the musicians stepping in and doing it keeps it fresh each night. It's their take on things. And also, there's so many great DJs at Radio 1, and everyone is their own DJ. It's not like you feel like on commercial radio. No disrespect to any commercial DJs or radio that are listening right now, because I enjoy my time there. But I think the way that the nature of playlists and things like that means that DJs are hemmed in, and therefore it's difficult sometimes to stamp your own personality on things. Therefore, a lot of the times you do, and it was for me at XFM was the same. You know, you end up kind of sharing techniques and styles a bit more and sharing the same songs. It's different at Radio 1 because, you know, whether you've got Hugh Stevens or Annie Mack or Nihal or Steve Lamack or whoever, you know, from the specialist department, you know, especially from my point of view, is going to take over that show. They're unique. They've got their own tastes. They'll bring their own flavor to it. So, nah, because it's... You know, and I'm proud of what I do. I think people dig it.
What we got up next, man?
Middle Class Rut. It was either going to be Queens of the Stone Age, which is an obvious fit for me, or I decided to go with something new again. These guys are influenced by Queens, Rage, Jane's Addiction, Refused. This is the round table of hard rock, modern hard rock. These are the people that, you know, you want to be talking to about riffs and guitar sounds. And Middle Class Rut have been listening, and there's two of them. They've been around in bands before, at least one band, I think. They had the classic, you know, story of being signed, lots of money wasted on an album that never came out, retreated back home, went into this garden, sort of into this shed at one of their parents' place, cranked up, made a racket, recorded it themselves, put it out there, and it's been hanging about for the longest time, like over a year, I think. And then someone hears it, tips somebody else off, and then they get a South by Southwest thing, and then a few other people, and then my friend told me about it, and... You know, we're all about it. Other people are picking up on it, and it's just building momentum. And all of a sudden, they're out gigging, playing the UK, and things are happening. So it's a classic case of a band that made the right music, and music just sort of breathes and lives of its own. And the album is like an 8-tracker, Middle Class Rut, MC Rut. It's online. You can pick it up. And this is a track called New Low. And this is just really, this is like a great example of brilliant American, aggressive, modern rock, the way it should be done.
I've seen
Middle Class Right New Low on Zane Lowe's mixtape.
That hasn't been used yet in a headline, by the way. Every other thing, every other pun relating to my last name has, but no one's done New Low yet, which is a relief. Down to, I'm sure.
A new low on a Radio 1 playlist.
There you go, it's a new low.
Have Middle Class Right made an appearance on your playlist, on your show?
Yeah, we got behind that big time. My friend Alex Gilbert, who ended up putting the first single out on 14th Floor, that's the label, he tipped me off to it, and we got behind it real quick, and they ended up doing a session for us last year as well. Yeah, I mean, the thing about Middle Class Right is, to me, they're an example of a band that get caught up in the industry and all the hype and everything else early on in their old band. And this music is a great example of what happens when you just retreat back to what you know and what knows you, and you just focus on music that's in. It just sounds very pure and very from the heart, and it's rough and rugged, but the mix is pretty amazing given it's just done in a shed. And, you know, a lot of the stuff is very old and done in one take and thrown out there. So, I mean, I'm really excited to see what they do next, but they're good, man.
You once told me that your Radio 1 show operates with a Trojan horse theory in mind. So you bring in the big guns and then they can be a door into a new artist. Is that very much a tactic that you still run with on the show?
Yeah, I mean, in the sense that we don't avoid bands because they're big now. You know, we're as excited about the return of Green Day as anybody. You know, and that's a big record for us, for our show. I don't want the show just to be this kind of steamroll effect or this freight train of new music that people aren't familiar with. I think that you need to be able to be excited about bands that people love and have a history with. I know I do. I mean, I love seeing Foo Fighters at Wembley last year, you know, as much as I love seeing a brand new band at the Barfly.
And you played records before that show,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I did that. I mean, it's, you know, it's a good room.
Just a little club set.
Yeah, it's a good room to play. I've done it four times now. It's great. What can I say? You know, but it, you know, the thing about the show is that we're trying to maintain careers as much as we are build them. And it's good for us to have bands have continued success because it means that they're, you know, we get good music and the audience keep coming back and want to find out, you know. And so when they hear a new Foo Fighters record, if you follow that up a few songs later with a Middle Class Right record, their ears are wide open.
Hopefully. It means you have a vested interest in these careers, right?
You know, as much as you can. Just it's more a vested interest in music, you know. And the career aspect is that's the band's core. That's their business. It's the management's business, whatever. But I have a vested interest in the music they make, and I just want the show to be the most exciting listen for 2 hours you can get across as many different genres of music, so that we can cover what's out there. And we're just looking for the goosebumps.
What we got up next on your mixtape?
This one you've already heard, Jeffrey Lewis. I played you before we started because I just couldn't wait to get your opinion on it. This is Williamsburg Will Oldham Horror. I think I got that in the right order, but I always mess it up. This guy's been around for a while, does music with his brother. Again, I was late on this. My friends said to me, you've got to see him at South by Southwest, and we ended up getting him in to do some stuff for MTV2, who I was out there with, so I got like a very private audience with a few other people to see him do a couple of tracks. And this was one of them, and yeah, just absolutely blew me away. He's one of the most talented artists, and that is in the general sense, I think, that is around at the minute. And like anyone who's trying different things, some of it's hit and miss, and you won't get all of it. But when he gets it right, I mean, all I can say about this record is that if you get the reference points, i.e. the Bonnie Prince Billy and the Will Oldham reference points, and you know New York City and the L Train and things like that, this was one hell of a ride. This is Williamsburg Will Oldham Horror.
Today I went to Major Math to remaster my old album, and on the L train in the morning I was pretty sure I saw Will Oldham. He was wearing the same sunglasses he had on stage at the Bowery Ballroom. Had he come to walk among the Williamsburgers of his kingdom? And like the burghers of Calais, will a sacrifice be demanded to offer up our dreams and beg for mercy empty-handed? And hapless in our hipness, crowded 5-2 in apartment, relegate our dreams to hobbies and deny our disappointment. Cause the Stones in 65 want total satisfaction, kid. But the Stones in 69 see grace in just getting what you need. But if that's a victory, then I'd hate to see what I'd look like defeated. Cause I know there are those who walk among us who seem to get their dreams unimpeded. Like today when I went to Major Maths to remaster my old album. On the L train in the morning, I was really sure I saw Will Oldham. He was wearing the same sunglasses he had on stage at the Bowery Ballroom. Had he come to walk among the Williamsburgers of his kingdom? You might say, now there's a guy who seems to have the world laid out before him. Or you might say he's just a rich kid or a fascist or a charlatan. But either way you say it, if you look at indie rock culture, you really can't ignore him. Even if at first dismissive, after some listens, you'll enjoy him. I was thinking this on the L train, intent on bursting my own bubble. How long should an artist struggle before it isn't worth the hassle? And admit we aren't fit to be the ones inside the castle. This quest for greatness, or at least hipness, just a scam and too much trouble. But then what makes one human being worthy of an easy ride? Born to be a natural artist, you love or hate but can't deny. While us minions in our millions tumble into history's chasm, we might have a couple laughs, but we're still wastes of protoplasm. Like today, I was gonna waste some time and money to remaster some dumb old album. And on the L train in the morning, I was really sure I saw Will Oldham, who's wearing the same big sunglasses he had on stage at the Bowery Ballroom. Had he come to see the strife here in the gutters of his kingdom, where us noble starving artists are striving hard to feed our egos. Our mothers like our music and our friends come see our shows. And if our friends become successful, we'll consider them our foes. Go home to our four roommates after paying big bucks for rock star shows. What a nightmare, what a horror. I don't want no part of this. Just get me off this crazy ride. I'm gonna puke, I'm gonna piss. I'd rather kill myself. I'd rather just relax or not exist. But you say you want to do an email interview. Oh, what the heck, I can't resist. Hey, Mom, guess what? Today I did another magazine interview. Honey, that's great, you're really famous. Yeah, and I'm 27 too. I kind of thought I was gonna grow up to do stuff that would benefit humanity, but it's getting harder to tell if this artist's life is even benefiting me. Cause today I was gonna waste some time and money to remaster some dumb old album. And on the L train in the morning, I was totally sure I saw Will Oldham. He was wearing the same big rock star sunglasses he had on stage at the Bowery Ballroom. And since I was feeling in need of answers, I just went right up and asked him. I said, Will, buying Prince Palace, whatever, what do you think about it? Is it worth being an artist or an indie rock star? Are you better off without it? Cause you know, maybe the world would be better if we were all just uncreative drones. No dead childhood dreams to haunt us, a decent job, a decent home. And if we had some extra time, we could do real things to promote peace. Become scientists or history teachers or uncorrupt police at least. Come on, Will, you gotta tell me. I grabbed and shook him by the arm. The L train was leaving Bedford with 10,000 white 20-somethings crowded on. He opened his mouth to speak, but was lost in the rumbling of the wheels. We were thrown together in a corner, and I yelled, tell me, man, for real. You're living comfortably, I assume, even if you're not quite a household name. You've reached a pretty high level of success and critical acclaim. And the L train got the First Avenue, and a bunch of people piled out. I was staring into his sunglasses, and I was really freaking out. I was like, Steamboat Willie, Bonnie Prince of all this shit. You're like the king of a certain genre, but even you must want to quit. Like if you hear a record by Bob Dylan or Neil Young or whatever, you must start thinking, yeah, people like me, but I won't be that good ever. And then I'm sure the thing is probably like Dylan himself too. Stayed up some nights wishing he was as good as Ginsberg or Camus, and he was like, dude, I'm such a faker, I'm just a clown who entertains. And these fools who pay for my crap, they just have pathetic puny brains. And then Camus probably wished it was Milton too, or whatever, you know what I'm saying? So will you be straight with me now? It's just us two on this train. Cause I was gonna spend some time and money today to remaster some dumb old album, and I saw you here on the L train, and I was like, hey, is that Will Oldham? He must at least have some perspective, cause it's like living in this town. I get so confused and wound up and uptight, and I just don't know up and down. And then we reached the last stop, and the subway was deserted. There was a long moment of silence, and I let go of his shirt. I started to think that maybe I'd made some kind of big mistake. I tried to walk out onto the platform, but by then it was too late. His sunglasses seemed to grow darker, and still he hadn't even spoke. He just came right up behind me and put his hands around my throat, and threw me down onto the concrete and kicked my face in with his boot, and dragged me down onto the train tracks and tied my hands back with his coat. And I was slipping out of consciousness as he was slipping down my jeans, and he was punching me and humping me, and I slipped off into a dream. So it might have just been a delusion, but I thought I heard him say something like, artists are pussies, and he clumped back up and ran away. So I lay there in the darkness on the train tracks, cold and broken. The hours passed, and I thought, well, maybe I won't remaster that old album. And then I started thinking, well, maybe it really wasn't even Will Oldham, even though he did hold my arms and me just like Will sings in A Sucker's Evening. But whether it was him or wasn't, I couldn't forget the words he'd spoken. Artists are pussies, like we're wusses, or we end up getting f***ed. And other kinds of folks are dicks, tall, smart, and strong, and born to f*** us up. I know it sounds really sexist and stupid, it's a terrible analogy, but at that moment on the train tracks, it made a lot of sense to me. Maybe it's just some kind of natural balance, like two types of mental gender that's gone on in all societies in one form or another. Like some dicks were born to conquer, I probably would if I could, but if I'm just a pussy, that's okay, because in a few months, maybe I'll put out something good.
That man can squeeze in a lot of words.
I've seen him do it live. Two takes on acoustic guitar. Didn't fluff it once. I mean, he must have done it a lot of times, but still. Amazing, you know? What a great, what a funny story to tell in relation to what it's like being an artist that isn't necessarily, you know, mainstream. If you like that and you ever get a chance to meet some of your other favourite bands, I bet you they like that too.
All right, that's a good recommendation. We've had to do a few nip and tucks to get that song to air. What can you get away with?
Oh, man, nothing right now. It's been a tough time for the BBC in terms of that. And with good reason. There's been questions asked and, you know, new processes put in place to ensure that, you know, the roles that we have in terms of facilitating the audience with what they pay for, the broadcasting fee, is rock solid, and it always has been, as far as I'm concerned, on my show, and anyone I've ever worked with at Radio 1 has always been. That's the one thing about the BBC is everyone takes that stuff so seriously. No one's up there going, oh, okay, well, we can get away. No one's trying to get away with nothing. You know, we all try to protect the anti-BBC as much as possible, and most importantly, protect the license fee payer. But things happen, and that means the spotlight was placed firmly on the BBC as a whole. And so as a DJ on a radio show, on Radio 1 right now, we are very fastidious about the content that we play.
Millions of shareholders. It's got to be done.
You're absolutely right. And we take it really seriously, really seriously, because we're proud of where we work. We love our jobs. We know how lucky we are. And we try and create, you know, radio and TV for people so that they feel lucky to have a BBC.
This is Music 101 on Radio New Zealand National. And we're in studio with Zane Lowe, who's presenting his mixtape.
Bored yet?
No way. Yeah. They're on board.
Ah, there you go. I haven't heard that for a couple of weeks.
What we got next, man?
Yeah, a weird one considering where we've gone, I think, from Diamond D to Tom York, Deadmau5, and Middle Class Rut, Jeffrey Lewis, now Audio Slave, because I'm not above a good slice of American rock. And I felt when Audio Slave came out, after I heard Cochise, it just blew me away. And I was a little bit skeptical about the debut album because I wanted Chris Cornell to be in Soundgarden and I wanted Zach to be in Rage Against the Machine, and it wasn't enough for me. And I've gone back and listened to that record again, the first one, the debut album, the first Audio Slave album, and I think it's great.
Were they the sum of their parts, Audio Slave?
In what sense?
Well, in the sense you had two mighty bands coming together on with Rick Rubin in production.
Yeah.
On paper, it looked like it was going to blow minds, and I don't know if they quite got there.
I don't think in the end they'll look back on all three albums and think that they got where they felt they could have, and it sort of petered out, but I think that they had some great moments, man. And I think the most of those great moments you'll hear on the first record.
Like a Stone.
It's a big tune. Cochise, big tune, you know. Show Me How to Live, big tune. And what's great about that first album is that you can hear Chris Cornell battling lyrically. And that's when Chris, to me, is at his best. I'm really happy that if he's happy, and I've met him, he's a really decent bloke. Nothing but time for Chris and respect.
But better when he's wrestling with God.
Well, no, it's just, for me, musically, that voice, there needs to be that kind of pain attached. And I would never want him to be in pain in order to create great art. That's just a waste of a life. But I'm glad that for whatever reason he's found a way throughout his life to express himself during those dark times. And you can hear it on that first Audio Slave record. And this track, I mean, Shadow of the Sun. Yeah, American rock done well, I think.
Once upon a time, I was of the mind to lay your burden.
I
Audioslave's Shadow of the Sun.
What a voice.
What a voice.
Chris Cornell, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, modern rock vocalist of the last 20 years.
And about to release a record with Timbaland on all of the production.
This is what I was trying to say before. I mean, I wish him nothing but success in whatever he does, but, you know, I like it when he rocks. But I'm looking forward to hearing what... I mean, I'll always listen to what Chris does, but on a solo level, I've struggled with him a bit throughout the years as a fan. But, you know, great moments on those Audioslave records, that being one of them. And I could go back and listen to Bad Motorfinger or Super Unknown any day and not press stop.
Rolling Stone recently did an issue with the 100 Greatest Vocalists of All Time.
Where was he?
He didn't make an appearance.
That's
he
just
actually,
depressing.
He wrote the byline for Jeff Buckley's entry, but he didn't make an appearance himself.
That's embarrassing. Actually, I think I read that, and I've got that edition somewhere, and I didn't notice, which is even more embarrassing.
But Ed Vedder wasn't on there. Perry Farrell wasn't
on
there.
That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous, man. I mean, but I suppose that they've got to consider soul, R&B,
sure,
gospel, everything else. But you'd think if you're going to, you know, put a small percentage away for rock and roll. I mean, I've only got, 10 tracks to choose from here? I could find room for Audioslave in our mixtape. They could find it in the top 100 singers. He's the greatest, him and Ed. I mean, I know Kurt deserves his place in there, obviously, because he, you know, his voice was directly attached to who he was and his being and his soul. And unfortunately, as we know now, you know, that wasn't in a very good place, and you can hear it in the music. But, you know, I like my singers alive, and I think Chris Cornell is just still one of the greatest. I mean, his work on Super Unknown is the range he hits, the power he hits. He's able to make it sound kind of like the classic American rock vocalist that were almost cheesy, but he does it gangster.
He can really sing anything, right? Back of a cereal box and that voice.
Yeah, he's like Beck. I mean, we had Beck on the show once, and I was trying to get him to jam, and it wasn't happening. And he was like, oh, I don't know, I've got no inspiration. And so the guy he was with, one of his touring band, gave him like a stapler box, and he just like sang the back of a stapler box. And by the time he got into the fourth language, which was like Portuguese, it was just the most amazing Beck single ever. He's like, you know, he's like, bovine metal construction, keep your hands clear. Insert staples carefully. But he's doing it. He closed her eyes. It's a Beck classic. You know?
Yeah. Zane Lowe's presenting his mixtape on Music 101 this afternoon. Zane, what's up next, man?
I've been lucky enough to spend some time with Damon Albarn of late. We went out to Mali as part of an Africa Express trip with a whole bunch of artists from Martha Wainwright and Jamie T and Norman Cook, and a bunch of us went out. Scratch from the Roots. And he just is an amazingly inspirational guy who's really, his whole thing is to open you up to exciting music, and he's just trying to find like-minded people who'll yell about it. You know, preach about it in the right way and expose it, you know, with a bit of knowledge. And so he's given us that knowledge. He's given me the starting point of that knowledge. And in doing that, we got him onto the show on a weekly basis, and still will in the new year, to pick a piece of music, that anything he wants, and we'll play it. Carte blanche for him. And it will always kind of be in the African vibe. So he's opened my ears up to a lot of funky African music, which has been his whole idea, I think, and this is just one of the great pieces of music, which came off I think it's like a Funky Sounds of Nigeria comp or something like that, and this is Ofo and the Black Company, and this is how they do it in Nigeria, boy.
The world of Africa.
Take that.
Heavy.
Literally corrupting, you know, whatever it is, just like fading into craziness.
Ofo and the Black Company, Allah Akbar.
Yeah, it's a heavy piece of music. That's the thing I noticed when I went out to Africa the most, is and subsequently, is just how amazing and funky their music is, and it's not that I didn't realize it, but you realize when you're hearing it in a very rough and rugged environment like this kind of makeshift bar with just some crates of warm beer and this tannoy system and these guys just jamming the same riff, not dissimilar to what you just heard over and over again for 15 minutes, and you just, that's, it's just the most amazing music, and you can hear all the different reference points and the stuff that I've listened to my whole life in one song. It's an amazing place and closer than you think.
You bought Becca Quetta records with you?
No, I didn't really go record shopping like that. I'm not really, the thing about record shopping is I don't have the patience for it. And that's a horrible thing for someone who's into new music to say. And as a kid, I was more into it. But I was lucky. I grew up with people who always had very deep crates and always up, like Rob Sam and Manuel Bundy. You know, people I've got lots of love and respect for, always very generous with their selections. So I got spoiled. So, and now with online, I just go online.
Digital digging.
I just find everything digitally, really. But if there's something I really want, obviously I'll go into Honest John's or somewhere and hunt it down. But no, I didn't go record shopping. We didn't really have a lot of time. I don't think anyone went record shopping the whole time we were there, because we were just going from one bar to someone's living room for an impromptu performance or scheduled performance, and then onto, you know, this, an amazing, you know, live performance by Salif Keithy, and we were just given the most amazing treatment by the people there, and we got exposed to some of the most incredible music. And Mali's a place that's just rich with fantastic music.
This is Music 101 on Radio New Zealand National. We're in studio with Zane Lowe. Where are you taking us next on your mixtape?
This is dodgy territory, I think, for some people. But
dodgy territory.
Yeah. This is the guilty pleasure, as they call it. But, you know, it's important that you, as you get a bit older, you acknowledge your roots. And I grew up in a time when FM radio was the big news, and my dad was heavily involved in that through Hauraki and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, nothing wrong with a bit of journey, you know. And I actually discovered the song again by watching Family Guy. And I just ignored the joke and went out and bought the song. It's a hell of a tune. I think Kanye has been adapting this to his live show as well. It's called Don't Stop Believing. And by all means, you don't have to play all of it if you don't want to, but it's certainly worth it for the first minute and a half.
Tell me, is this the song that made an appearance in the last episode of the Sopranos?
I don't know. I've never been a Sopranos watcher, but probably.
I think this was the actual song that took out the series.
Probably was. I mean, listen to it. This is as cinematic as 80s soft rock gets, 70s soft rock gets.
Just a small town. Living in a lonely world, she took the midnight train going anywhere. Just a city boy, born and raised in South Detroit. He took the midnight train going anywhere. A singer in a smoky room, the smell of wine and cheap perfume. For a smile they can share the night. It goes on and on.
Zane Lowe taking us into MOR territory.
Well, it's cool now,
journey.
You told me it's a Sopranos thing, so that's the coolest thing we played on the whole mixtape.
Hey, true story. Yeah, if HBO are behind it.
Yeah, Journey, Don't Stop Believing, and
with the lighters up for that one.
Yeah, it's a big record, that one, huh? That's kind of when, I think for a lot of people, that's when Springsteen influences went wrong. That's when, like, what Springsteen was doing with the piano and the driving kind of, like, road music, like, you know, pack your bags, we're leaving this, you know, this hard luck town, we're getting out of here, you know, and that's when people just thought that it's gone really wrong. But it's a classic example of music over time, finding its place and through things like Sopranos and Kanye and whatever context you hear it in, all of a sudden a song that was probably considered well cheesy back in the day is, I think it sounds dope. I want to remix it. Put a beat under it.
What artists are running with the Journey baton these days? Is it Nickelback? I mean, who's actually holding a flame for MOR radio?
God, I wouldn't know. I mean, yeah, you've got your Hinders and bands like that. That's certainly not my cup of tea, but I think the British do pretty well in that department as far as America's concerned. And this isn't some kind of like pre-organized segue, but I think what we're going to play next is a good example of a credible MOR band now, you know. And they probably hate me for saying that, but
their music is geared up for a lot of arenas, stadiums.
Yeah, you know, and I think that they do it in a creative way.
We're talking about Coldplay.
We are, yeah, and they do it in a creative way. You know, there's certainly that they certainly tailor it for that, but I think the audience get the same buzz out of a Coldplay gig that they probably would have at the time out of a Journey gig. You know, which is a big sing-along, stand-up moments, bit of a light show and lots of songs to sing along to and connect with. And I was lucky enough to be involved in something that Coldplay related at the end of the year. It was an interview for an American TV show, hasn't aired yet. And that was really the angle they were taking, you know, what makes this band so connect with so many people on such a massive level with gigs or albums, whatever. Because they're one of the few big bands that are selling a lot of albums. And, you know, I think that they've got that chemistry, the four friends of them, and they just know how to make big sounding records, but not like sound deliberate. And I'm going to play a track that's off the Prospect March EP, which came after the last album, which I thought was a really good record. But this is a brilliant song, I reckon, and a classic example of Coldplay's ambition done right. This is what happens when they kind of put all their ideas into one place and actually works. And really brave them not to put this on the album, because this is one of the favorite things that they've ever done. And I guess it just didn't fit cohesively with everything else they want to put on the record, so it found its place on the EP. But this is like the great sort of untapped Coldplay monster single, I think, A Glass of Water.
Coldplay, Glass of Water on Zane Lowe's mixtape.
Something about being a dad now that makes Coldplay's music resonate even more.
Dad rock, eh?
It's so true, though. I mean, I love Parachutes, but now I've become a father, I go back and listen to Coldplay, and it's hard not to get a little
bit weepy. You're my special boys.
But they're a great band, and I think history will reveal them to be smarter and more creative than perhaps people think now because of the level of their success. And I think that they're aware of that, which is why they're making records like they are. I think they've crossed that boundary now between worrying so much about it. I think they'll always be a worrying band. That's what will drive them. Like, you two obviously still worry. They still go, like, how can we top what we've done before and top what everyone else is doing? But I think that they know their place now. They sound confident with what they do.
Chris Martin seems like a worrier.
Yeah, he's endearing. Endearingly worrisome. Yeah, man. He's, you know, for someone like that, I guess putting your art out there is not an easy thing. And then when you start selling records, I think the general feeling he had, and this has been established by him in print as well as in interviews, is that, you know, do we deserve it? But this is what, album number four, and yeah, they're doing it, and yeah, still doing it, and still making the largest selling album of the year. Thank God it's that and not, to me, something that was substandard.
We've got Zane Lowe in studio, and you're closing your mixtape out on some black nationalist hip-hop music.
From Coldplay to Public
Coldplay
Enemy.
Coldplay to Public Enemy, yeah.
In one easy step. Yeah, I mean, I think I've ended this a few times. I've ended whatever I've been doing, whether it's this kind of thing or it was the closing track for my DJ set a lot of times. It is Public Enemy. For me, they were at their most potent in the transition from It Takes a Nation and Fear of a Black Planet, those two albums. But Shut 'Em Down actually features on the following record, which I think is Apocalypse 91.
Yeah.
And is the remix, to me, is what really makes this song come alive. It's Pete Rock's best ever remix, and he was the hottest hip-hop producer and remixer for a couple of years.
What were some Pete Rock signatures in terms of the material he was digging
for? Horn stabs.
Horn stabs.
you know, a lot of like repeating horns, filtered down kind of funk sounds. So you get the bass would be what will be the overriding sound, but you could still hear the filtered down instruments in the background, just kind of like filling it out. And just the best drum sounds at the time. Everyone was really jealous of Pete Rock's drum programming. He had the best, and he was one of the first hip hop producers to separate the break. So people would just like loop breaks, you know, take a James Brown break or a whatever break and just kind of like loop it up. And he would take the kick, the hat, the snare, put it through the SP-12, whatever he was using, and program, reprogram it, replay it. And he was one of the first producers to do that. And that was hugely innovative and kind of was the blueprint for how hip-hop was made from that point forward. And even though people use drum machines more now because everyone's terrified of samples, it's still how they operate. And he was a real forerunner in that department. Had a great rapper with him, CL Smooth. They were Pete Rock and CL Smooth, but also did some great remixes. House of Pain, Jump Around, Das Effects, and this one.
Down with the King.
Yeah, Down with the King. That's Rage of I mean, he saved that.
Yeah.
You know, and the Run DMC record. And he was just the remixer of choice, and this is his best ever remix to me, which is high praise because he's pretty good. And this is Pete Rock, the remix of Public Enemy's Shut Him Down. You play this in any environment, be it, you know, joyous or somber, and people will find themselves moving without actually realizing it's something real.
Step down when I'm in your town. You know I got to shut them down.